The book is about the ascendancy of Kevin McCarthy to the speakership. We'll get to that, I promise you. But is it possible, John, that his removal as speaker was foreshadowed by the way he became speaker?
Perhaps, and I know I've heard that from a lot of folks. First of all, thanks for having me on,
sure.
Major. I appreciate it. But, you know, one thing we really understood innately with these tight margins is your job's on the line every day when you're Speaker of the House. You're at the mercy of 218 individuals, right? And so although a lot's been made about the motion to vacate, there's other ways to remove a speaker. You can just sit on your hands and not vote for a rule. You could do a discharge petition to remove a speaker. You could overturn the ruling of the chair that a motion to vacate's not in order. And so I think we got comfortable with the idea that, listen, every single day of the week, our job's on the line. We're willing to put our best out there and see what it led to. But we did have a group that was not going to go along, and I think we recognized that as well.
And that truism, that there were lots of different ways in which you could oust a speaker elected by your party, is that, from your vantage point, John, now that you're on the outside, something that any majority party who wants to run the House effectively better come to grips with? Because if your leadership lives in constant sort of fear that one or two discontented members can topple your speakership, how effective, how aggressive, how courageous can you be?
Yeah. Well, I think, and I think Kevin might have had to have been a sacrificial lamb for that cause, because we did see Mike Johnson as well face a motion to vacate resolution that thankfully a bipartisan majority of Democrats and Republicans stepped in and tamped down. I think if you gave truth serum to most House Democrats, they would admit that what they did to Kevin was not the right thing for the institution. But sometimes you have to touch the stove.
Right.
And we saw those 3 weeks where we didn't have a leader. It was very dangerous. You know, Israel was attacked in that period of time.
Right. October 7th happened.
Exactly. Just that weekend after. The House could not act. We were paralyzed.
Completely paralyzed.
And I think if you're a strong Article 1 advocate like I am, if you're an advocate for the House of Representatives, being a voice in this government, you should be an advocate for a strong speaker, whether that's Republican or Democrat. And so I think hopefully all the members that are around during that time internalize that moving forward.
Quick civics lesson. Article 1 enumerates the powers of Congress. That's why it's first, which I know you care about.
Yes, absolutely. And the first officer listed in the Constitution is the Speaker.
Right. So the title of the book is Glory, Grief, and the Gavel. Washington loves alliteration, so well played there. An inside guide to running for the Speaker of the House. Another title of the book could be You Have to Be Able to Count and You Can't Quit. Subtitle, Matt Gaetz is a weasel.
I'm not a fan of Matt's. You do need to be
clearly,
able to count.
Clearly not a fan.
No. He knows that. And I say in the end,
he's portrayed as a weasel throughout the book.
Well, and there's a saying that I think is true. If you seek revenge, dig two graves. You know, Matt really wanted to stop us in January from becoming speaker. That's what I think the removal was about as well. It was not about policy, right? All those individuals that voted against Kevin, they voted for continuing resolutions 7 more times in the 2 years that followed. So it was not about those issues. It
right,
was
because
about
Kevin was ousted, theoretically, because he agreed to have Democrats come aboard for a continuing resolution.
It was a 30-day government funding bill at a flat funding level, which, again, as I note in the book, we adopted 7 more of those in the 2 years to come. So
it couldn't have been about that, is your point.
No, I don't believe it was.
And so what was it about?
Again, I think Matt had an agenda in January to stop Kevin from being speaker. He almost succeeded.
Yes,
I write
he
about
did.
The book, about the 15 rounds, how we had to break them and go around him. But then I think he saw some discontent in the ranks and seized, you know, the option in the removal vote. But again, it led to his downfall as well. And, you know, that the House suffered, obviously, in those 3 weeks. But again, I hope in the long term, folks see we can't go down that path again.
How do you evaluate the speakership of Mike Johnson?
I think he's doing a good job. You know, I'm a golfer. I don't know if you are, Major. But
I am. I'm a terrible golfer, but I do play.
Well, you'll like this saying.
One of my afflictions in life.
You'll like this saying as a House Republican, I believe, you know, there's no pictures on a scorecard.
Right.
So it doesn't always look pretty, but if you get the job done, that's all that counts. And they've gotten the reconciliation bill done. They've gotten all the must-pass bills done. And so I think he's doing a great job.
And you have to play it as it lays.
That's right. And it's a very tight margin, right? No one knows that more than we did. And that's the newest, I think, facet of the House that people need to think about moving forward is the battlefield has shrunk. It's going to be one way or another, I think, give or take 10 seats in the House. And so you have to deal with the members you have. Any member wakes up on a certain day of the week in a bad mood, you got to deal with them. But Mike's doing a great job. I know a lot of people on his staff, they're doing a great job. And far be it from me to throw stones at the people that are in the arena.
So that 15 rounds, that week-long process that ultimately led to Kevin McCarthy becoming Speaker of the House, lots of people who don't pay any attention to politics watched and watched closely and found themselves, for maybe the only time in their life, enraptured by C-SPAN coverage of House floor proceedings. So what's in the book that they don't know, that you think they need to know?
That's right. Well, yeah, we had millions watching. I had a Romanian legislator recognize me on a Kodo and said, I know you. You were during the speaker rounds. You were next to Kevin.
Big in Romania.
Pope Francis told Kevin when they had an audience with the Pope that he was watching. You know, you have multi-ballot elections for Pope.
There were some echoes of a conclave.
That's right. Definitely. And so not as beautiful as the Sistine Chapel and maybe not as reverent, but the thing I...
Just as political.
Definitely just as political, yes. The three lessons I say in the book that we filed that I don't know if folks knew that we were following, but they were our North Star that week. The first one was always have the candidate be visible and be seen. And I think that's the lasting image of Kevin during that fight is him out there smiling, taking it in stride. That's where I got some TV time on C-SPAN sitting next to him.
And the alternative was not have him on the floor, but have him someplace else just off the floor so you could have meetings. And you could rationalize that. That would not necessarily be a strategically tragic mistake, but you decided at the beginning, and we'll get to who gave that advice to you in a minute, because I know him very well.
Yes.
Stay on the floor.
Yeah.
Maintain your visibility.
Absolutely. It's very hard, as we decided, to vote against someone when they're sitting 20 feet away from you and smiling.
At least it's harder.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Second
rule. Be more organized than the opposition, right? We had text chains going. We had different members assigned different pockets on the floor to kind of sense if there was any discontent brewing. We had members actually babysit certain defectors with them from the office to the House floor to make sure the last voice in their head was a positive one.
For Kevin.
For Kevin, absolutely. And so I think that was something that was in our favor. And the third rule, most important, never let an alternate emerge. There were other members.
And gain steam.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you do that, you have real problems. And there were members that I think would be great candidates for speaker, Steve Scalise at the time, Jim Jordan, others. We were, you know, one team and they were behind us. Those two men I just mentioned gave the nominating speeches for Kevin after Elise Stefanik gave the inaugural speech. And so I think we showed there was no daylight. And that was the three rules we followed and they carried us through.
And the person who helped you understand those three rules, not a household name in Washington today, but was when I first got here in the early 1990s, Vin Weber, who was the lieutenant of Newt Gingrich.
Yeah.
I knew them both very well when they were in the minority party in the House in the early 1990s. Then they became ascendant. Then they became the majority party for the first time in 40 years. Vin gave you that advice.
Absolutely. Yeah. So Dan Meyer, our chief of staff, worked with Vin, knew him from Minnesota. And they said, what we're going through is not analogous to whipping a bill, because that's what I was used to on Capitol Hill, right?
You have a bill. Find the votes for this particular piece of legislation.
And then call the vote.
Right.
We didn't have that luxury, right? We couldn't decide when votes were. We were at the mercy of the House. And so they said, this is really more like a nominating convention. And in the state of Minnesota, you still do have these nominating conventions where people want to get the nomination of the party. And they have to go through multiple ballots. That used to be more of a mainstay in our politics for presidential campaigns. That's gone away quite a bit. But that was the analogy we thought was most apt for us. And Vin had run a couple of those delegate counting operations in Minnesota. Again, something that we had never done. This had not happened in a century, Major. No one alive was around the last time a speaker's ballot went multiple ballots.
Right.
And I actually had a conversation with one of Speaker Pelosi's top aides. And I said, you know, I think we're going to get there. And he said, I think you will too. It just depends what you have to give them. And I said, and how many votes it takes. He said, no, if it takes more than one, you're done.
Right.
And I thought that was
the assumption was if you don't win the first time, you're cooked.
It's over. And there were a lot of members that I think felt the same way, right? They thought if he goes one or two rounds, and we kept hearing that there's going to be a defection of 10 on this vote, 15 on this vote. It never happened. And again, those rules from Vin really helped.
And there's a portion of the book where you indicate one particular morning, everyone was a little wobbly, including Kevin McCarthy.
Yeah. Yeah. The second morning, I woke up, I texted a colleague, Ben Howard mine, a friend of yours, and I said, it feels like the walls are closing in, you know?
And there's no way out.
We tried to talk with the holdouts the night before. They were nowhere to be found. They felt they were winning. We felt strong that we'd held our group, but Kevin actually talked to us that morning and said, guys, you need to have a will in place. And if it's not me, who should it be? And we had a brief conversation. It wasn't a long conversation, but there was a little bit of seriousness imbued in that conversation of, you know, this might not happen and we got to have a plan in place. It certainly kicked us into gear to say, we're not going to let this guy down. We're going to go figure this thing out. But yeah, there were moments where, again, he was sunny on the floor. We were sunny on the floor. We kept each other up. But always moments of doubt creep in a tense time like that.
How close did America come, John, around that 14th and 15th vote to witnessing what we see in some other countries that have less stable institutions than we do, a fist fight within parliament? We don't have a parliament, but a fist fight on the floor of the House of Representatives.
Yeah.
How close were they?
I don't think that close. I think the photos made it look more dramatic. Mike Rogers was the individual, going to have a word with Matt Gaetz.
Right.
I think there was a thought he might, you know, get more confrontational, and Mr. Hudson pulled them back. I've talked to a lot of those guys. There was never going to be physical violence that day, but the tensions were real. The tensions were high. This was, you know, unscripted. Most of Congress is...
And the reason the tensions were high were not just about the stakes, but the perception, and you argue in the book it's actually real, that Matt Gaetz went back on his word.
Absolutely. Yeah, we had a conversation that afternoon, and we walked into this back room off the House floor. Matt Gaetz shook Kevin's hand and said, "Congratulations, Mr. Speaker. You're going to be..."
Use those words. "Congratulations, Mr. Speaker."
Those are the first words out of his mouth. And I was thinking to myself, what is this, right? And he said, "We may adjourn it, but you're going to be our speaker tonight. And here's how it's going to work. And Lauren Boebert's going to vote for you. I'll vote president if need be. That'll put you over the top." And then in between that conversation and the next series of votes at 9 p.m., Matt's other defectors were not going to go with him. And he did not want to be seen as the one that, you know, put Kevin over the top.
Who made the peace.
Exactly. And so he wanted to postpone it. He was also trying to ask for a gavel on Mike Rogers' subcommittee on armed services. So Mike Rogers was none too pleased with that. And I think that's what some of the tension was at that time on the floor.
So, you know, I used the phrase "make the peace" intentionally.
Yes.
It's from The Godfather.
That's right.
There's a reference in the book, and it's a somewhat well-known reference now within at least House Republican circles to the five families.
Mm-hmm.
That's a reference to The Godfather, the first one, Godfather 1, where there has to be some accommodation made by potentially warring factions within organized crime in New York. How far does that analogy actually work within the Republican House conference?
Yeah. We're not as violent, again, as the five families of New York, but we do have our ideological groups. And that was meant to be an icebreaker, truly. We had a moment after Thanksgiving, after the election, before the January balloting, where we wanted to hash this out in a room. We did not want to hash it out on the floor. We wanted to hash it out in a room, get a negotiation, get an agreement, and understand of how we're going to operate. And I sat back and thought about the people we're inviting, and we actually had five groups represented. We had the RSC. The
Republican
group,
Study Committee.
Correct. The oldest conservative bloc. The Tuesday group, the more moderate kind of Northeasterners. The Main Street Caucus.
Midwesterners.
Mm-hmm. The Problem Solvers.
Problem Solvers.
Democrats.
Bipartisan. And then the
obviously the Freedom Caucus. And so it was meant to be an icebreaker because you could cut the tension in the room. Everyone was tense going in there.
Because there was underperformance in the midterms themselves.
Yeah.
So the majority was going to be narrow. And it took a long time to even figure that out.
Yeah.
So Kevin McCarthy did not come in with a big wind at his back.
Correct. Correct.
And there was a lot of recriminations about why the red wave didn't show.
Sure. Yeah. I think that
was the backdrop of all.
Absolutely.
Of this.
We didn't have the election called on election night. We didn't have it called almost until Thanksgiving.
Right.
Right. So that was unprecedented. I think that's going to be more common in the years to come. As I said, the battlefield's way tighter these days in the House. But that was a first. And so we were trying to get everyone to realize, I know you might not like this group over here. You might not like that group over there. But we all have to work together because any one group can hold the other up. Five members is all it takes on the floor on any given day to stall any bill. And so we all need to get this together as a family, work it out on the front end, be there on the takeoff, be there on the landing. Otherwise, we're going to kill each other.
Right. And whatever the agenda was that was promised in the midterm conversation.
Yes, correct. Correct.
Explain to my audience, because some may not appreciate the difference, the essential difference between the House and the Senate in its majoritarian orientation.
That's right. That's right. The House is a majoritarian body through and through. If you have 218 votes, you can do whatever you want.
Whatever you want, any given day.
Any given moment. There's always a way. And conversely,
that's why you have to be able to count.
Exactly. Exactly. And conversely, if you don't have 218, it doesn't matter. You can't even adjourn the House.
Right.
Right. And so that was what was unique that week, too, was we didn't have any rules in place. We had to abide by the will of 218 people, whether or not they wanted to recess, adjourn, or not.
Right.
So the first night we were able to adjourn because Democrats had some parties they wanted to get to. But after that, they told me, we're not helping you. You've got to get your guys on the same page and vote to adjourn. Otherwise, we'll be here all day, all night.
And if the shoe had been on the other foot, that's what Republicans would have
done. Sure, absolutely. Yeah.
Because when you're not in the majority, you have no incentive.
Yeah.
From a policy or political perspective to help the majority party.
Yep.
Unless they give you something in return up front.
Yeah, and that was all we could offer that first night.
And there's nothing you can offer when you're not even an organized house.
That's right.
You're not going to offer you can't offer them the speakership.
No. Yeah. You know, we had to learn. We had to learn on the fly. And again, like you said, if the shoe was on the other foot, I know Nancy Pelosi had her battles as well, where she had to give and take. And we were not going to help her, you know, get those votes for speaker in any way. That's what you do in the minority. So I don't blame them. That's just the reality of the case.
You're not an expert and you're not meant to be on Democratic House caucus politics, but you have friends over there. Mm-hmm. You have to when you're a floor leader and work within the leadership ranks. So there are some interesting conversations going on in House Democratic races. Democratic Socialists of America are weighing in. There are some divisions over Palestinians, Israel, AI. If there is a House Democratic majority after this midterm, I don't know if there will be or not, but the polls indicate that's certainly possible. Do you foresee a situation where House Democrats could have their own pockets that could be as rebellious as the pockets you had to deal with?
I do believe so. I think that
that's going to be a new feature of American
legislative politics
at the federal level.
I do. I think we are, and this is what the 15 ballots were about in some ways, is we're becoming a parliamentary system, right?
Whether we want to or not.
Exactly. Now, they're under the moniker and they caucus with the Democrats, they caucus with the Republicans, but there's factions. And so there was, you know, 200 or so traditional Republicans. There's also 20 or so Freedom Caucus, America First, however you want to characterize them, members. And that's what Kevin was doing. We were trying to cobble together a majority like you see in parliaments around the world. I would not be surprised. I think, you know, Jeffries is in a good position. That said, if it's a tight majority, all it takes is 3, 4, 5. Even Speaker Pelosi had to fight and give concessions, create select committees, put AOC on A committees, things like that to get the gavel herself. He will have a fight because there's going to be a group that wants to wrest power for their group and their ideology as well.
John, do you find it ironic, as I do, that as we are about to celebrate our 250th birthday as a country, we are creeping toward a parliamentary system of federal government?
Perhaps. That said, I did take some...
I mean, that wasn't the idea, actually. No. It was exactly the opposite.
Yes, but, you know, they also didn't want firm partisanship either, right? And so the party...
We didn't even have it until...
Correct. So, you know,
the elections to succeed George Washington.
That's right. I was heartened in some ways when I was researching this book, reading about Speaker Cannon going through his own, you know, group of rebellious detractors. I read Undaunted Courage this summer, and Thomas Jefferson had a group that was against the Louisiana Purchase, right?
Yep,
so we've always
had
factions. We've always had these folks who I think we look at with, you know, rose-colored glasses, that there's always factionalism. There's always rough campaigning.
Right. Factionalism is a reality. No question about it. But factionalism that will do real visible damage to your party
is new.
Different.
That's new. Yes.
That's different.
That's new. And that's what we contended with.
Because factions always vie and spar in private.
Yes.
Maneuver. Until they're outmaneuvered.
Yeah.
They did against Lincoln, they did against Nixon, they did against Reagan, they did against Roosevelt. You know, that's always true. What it feels to me different is, no, we will take our factionalism, which has historically been internal, and we will run it out externally. Then we will take that external pressure point, and if we don't get our way, we'll knock you out of office.
That's right, yeah.
That's different.
I say that in the book as well, you know, and that's my plea as, you know, to the Freedom Caucus on some level, is they talk about legislative leverage a lot. Leverage comes from your party staying united against the other party, against the Senate, against the president, wherever it may be, and getting the best deal you can. And we can either do that and stick together and continue to take steps in our direction, or we can cede the playing field entirely and go over the cliff draped in a jersey of purity. And I think that's what some of these guys would rather do. It's easier when you're primary, when you're just voting no. That's a problem. And again, I think our side struggles with it more. I had a conversation with my House Democrat colleague who, again, said, you know, you'll get this rule passed. I think it was on reconciliation.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, we lost a lot of rules too. I said, no, you didn't. You guys never lost a rule. They said, oh yeah, that's right. Our guys had the courtesy enough to tell us before we went to the floor, and we'd hash it out before we went to the floor. Your guys, you know, vote no on the floor, and you've seen these multi-hour votes on the floor to get to a solution. Some of that's just how the House Republican Conference works. We're a rambunctious, sometimes cannibalistic group. But you're right. We got to stick together. I think any party politics needs to stick together if they want to get policy in their direction.
Something your book goes into great detail about, which was evident at the time, as this was getting near the end, the Freedom Caucus started asking for things beyond a single person being able to offer a motion to vacate the chair of the speakership. They started wanting specific things on specific committees for specific members.
Yeah, correct.
And that goes to, they felt that they had improper or inadequate representation. Representation to them mattered. Visibility, prominence matters. And as you, I think, subtly suggest, that is a form, one could argue, of diversity, equity, and inclusion.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
You could have hammered that a lot harder.
I try to be subtle. But yes, they were, there was two levels of it. Again, on the one hand, I think Kevin was very open to using the five families analogy. We all got to work together. And so did we put Freedom Caucus members on some good committees? Yes. But did we also put problem solvers like Brian Fitzpatrick on A committees? Yes, because you guys got to figure this out, right? We can't have no votes in committee and expect to turn those around by the time it comes to the floor. So that was something we were content to do. What we were not content to do was give gavels to individual members. And that was the offer I described in the chapter, a modest proposal of Matt Gaetz saying, I'm going to be the chair of this subcommittee. Scott Perry is going to be the chair of this subcommittee, et cetera, et cetera. We said firmly, no, we're not giving gavels. We're not punishing anyone necessarily, but we're not rewarding anyone for holding us out. And that, I think, modest proposal, as I mentioned, really radicalized the conference. There was a group that, you know, felt like we shut them out, that group of 20, but the 200 stuck with us when they heard that's what these guys were really going after.
Right.
People are fine with process reforms and making a more inclusive party. They're not fine with you holding the conference hostage so you get a reward for yourself. And that, I think, helped keep those 200 with us the whole week.
So there were rewards you were not going to dispense, but you were also held to this standard of no retribution at all. In the rear view, was that unwise?
I've spent many a night thinking about that, because they mentioned that several times, the Freedom Caucus. That was always one of their demands, is no retribution. And Kevin used the Ted Lasso line, you know, what's the happiest animal? A goldfish, because he had his 5-second memory. We got to forget about this whole week in January if we're going to get anything done. I've thought about it, but again, with the margins as they are, one idea we explored was, what if we put a rule into our conference procedures that if you author or you support a motion to vacate without the support of the party, you're no longer a member of the party. Now they don't get committees, they're kicked off, they could lose their seats because of that. We thought about that, and I think maybe that would make them think twice, but if you kick 6 members out of your party, you're not in the majority anymore. And now we're right back at square one. So again, the truth is that everyone has leverage over everyone. There was a group of members that just didn't like Kevin and were not gonna vote for the things we were putting on the floor just because it was him, right? They voted for a lot of those same things.
What was that about? What's the I hate Kevin part about? Well, I know you're a huge fan, and the book, it goes into great detail about your obvious professional admiration for him and personal affection for him. I understand that.
Sure.
But what's the hate Kevin part, if you can be objective about it for a second?
Well, I write in the book that we actually were up against something called what I dubbed the curse of the majority leader. No one in my lifetime.
No. There was something personal about Kevin. What was it?
Again, I think he was in that position for so long. You get saddled with the votes, and there was a characterization of him as being, you know, establishment. You have to vote for the debt ceiling when you're a member of leadership. You have to vote for government funding. And so, listen, he was not, you know, the most beloved amongst the Twitter, X, grassroots, you know, base. I get that. But again, I think with Gaetz, it was something a little separate. And with those holdouts, there was multi-factions. The Never Kevins, led by Gaetz, was a personal thing. And then there may be Kevins who we ended up getting on the team eventually. They wanted those process reforms I talked about.
Walk me through the Donald Trump of it all.
Yeah. Well, he comes in a couple scenes in the book throughout the whole journey, really, because the book's not just about that, you know, 1 week in January, but also Kevin ran in 2015 and we didn't get there. And at the time, then candidate Trump sort of took credit for that and said, people are giving me credit. I said, you really need a strong person in charge. That led obviously to Paul Ryan being speaker. So he was involved throughout the whole process.
Well, yeah. And let's all remember that the first person after January 6, 2021, in significant Republican circles to be pictured smiling with Donald Trump was Kevin McCarthy.
Yeah. Yeah. Kevin spotted the rise of Trump, I think, before a lot of others in this town did.
Yeah, but that wasn't the rise. That was the rehabilitation.
Sure, absolutely.
And that was strategic.
They remain close. They were close in that period of time. They remain close to this day. And then Trump, I detail in the book, the New York Times covered it this weekend. You know, he helped close some of those final holdouts. He had a rather animated conversation with Andy Biggs. And, you know, there's the famous photo of Matt Rosendale, former Representative Rosendale, sort of pushing away the phone when he saw Trump was calling. So that was definitely something that we had in our, you know,
was he more arsenal. Important or was Marjorie Taylor Greene more important?
All of the above, right? Kevin was at bring him into the table. Marjorie, Jim Jordan, Donald Trump, voices on the
Patrick
outside.
Patrick McHenry,
you name it, right? I mean, the list of people that were supporting us in 2023 was pretty long, and it spanned the ideological faction. So, you know, again, I know what the characterization might have been of Kevin as being quote unquote establishment, but he truly, I think, had a real relationship with these folks, you know, members in the media, et cetera.
And then why couldn't President Trump save him? And why didn't he try?
I think at the time we knew you got to be the speaker on your own two legs. You can't call President Trump. And that was in between the first and second terms. You can't call him every day to resolve a rule vote. You can't call him every day to resolve a discharge petition.
Right. But when it was in the clutch and Kevin's whole speakership was on the line.
That was, again, a 30-day government funding resolution. We made the decision that if it wasn't that, guess what? It was going to be the NDA they wouldn't be happy with, or the next government funding vehicle, or whatever else was coming down the pike. It was, again, it was an ideological thing. It was a personal thing that we decided we did not want to be going through this and putting the House through this every single week over a must-pass item. That's no way to operate, you know, a rodeo.
Third shortest speakership in American history. Only speaker to be vacated by a vote of his party. What is the legacy of Kevin McCarthy?
Well, he was in leadership for a lot longer.
Right.
Obviously, the speakership, yes, but you know, he was a member of leadership for over a decade.
Is he a prism through which to view something else?
From my end, the legacy is someone who helped elect more Republican minorities, women, and veterans than any time in our history. He's someone that enacted the largest deficit reduction bill with a Democrat in the White House, helped establish the bipartisan Select Committee on China. He helped win back the House not once, but twice, pioneered new ways to raise money, to elect candidates. There's probably not a Republican in Washington today that in some way doesn't have Kevin to thank for helping them get elected to office. And so, again, I think from the speakership end, I hope if what happened to him is a way to stabilize the House and say we should never go down that road again, that's a legacy I'm proud to live with. But the body of work from Majority Whip, Majority Leader, Minority Leader, Speaker of the House, I think is one that he can stand on. And I hope when viewers read this book, we'll understand a little bit better as well.
Before I let you go, there's a member I want to invoke the name of who I didn't expect to read in the book, Marcy Kaptur, Democrat from Ohio.
Yeah.
Tell my audience that story.
Yeah, it went unreported. I'm surprised. But in between the 14th vote and the 15th vote, Marcy Kaptur came over to Mike Turner, one of her delegation mates from Ohio.
From Ohio, right.
On our side of the aisle, he was the chair of the Intel Committee.
Longest serving woman in the House.
Correct.
Marcy Kaptur.
And she said, Mike, this isn't right, you know? And you mentioned at the top, you know, the minority party never wants to help the majority party.
Right.
But she just saw, this isn't right. We can't continue to do this. And had she flipped her vote, Kevin would have been elected speaker, actually, a ballot earlier. And she was pretty close to doing it, we thought. Her and Mike Turner had a conversation. He said, I'll go with you right now. I'll walk with you to well. You can change your vote and this will all be over, right? She would have just had to vote present and we would have won. And the minority whip at the time, Catherine Clark, swooped in, intercepted her. They'd heard some rumblings that this was potentially in the works. We weren't soliciting Democrat votes, but she just sat there and said, I don't think this is right for the House. And there was a moment where she contemplated it.
And there was a moment where you would have taken that.
Sure.
On that term.
I think so. Again, I'm glad in the end it worked out that we got the, you know, vote with all Republicans. Maybe that would have started us off on a wrong foot, but for the institution, it would have been nice to see, I think, that level of bipartisanship and say, let's put, you know, the House above the parties.
That's the nugget I did not know and did not expect to read in the book.
Yeah.
The book, Glory, Grief, and the Gavel, an inside guide to running for the Speaker of the House. John Legansky, thank you.
Major, thanks for having me on.
Appreciate it.